The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I would say my biggest concern is that mix of people who think they're protecting their own right combined with voter intimidation, that people who have a genuine belief that their right to vote is being taken away. And they're going to show up at the polls and exercise that right. But that might mean coming armed. It also might mean trying to intimidate the people they believe are fake voters who are voting in the millions.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 2nd, 2020. Election day is tomorrow, and we're all hoping for a peaceful election day, but some people are worried about violence at the polls. Two of them are Dan Byman and Colin Clark. Byman, as listeners know, is a senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings. He's also the foreign policy editor of Lawfare and, of course, a professor at Georgetown University. Colin Clark is a senior research fellow at the Safon Center and assistant teaching professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Together, they have written on the Brookings FixGov blog, Why the Risk of Election Violence is High. It's an alarming piece, brief and full of facts that we probably don't want to think about the day before the election, which is precisely why they joined me in the Jungle Studio on Friday to think about them. It's an unnerving conversation, it's a scary conversation, and it's one I think people should face up to and have both with each other and themselves. It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 2nd, Daniel Byman and Colin Clark on violence at the polls. I want to start with the premise of the piece that you guys wrote, which is that the United States is at high risk of political violence in the context of the ongoing election. And I want you to justify that premise. I know that tensions are relatively high in a politically polarized environment, but there has not been any election violence at the polls to speak of. And the skeptic will say, wait a minute, is the premise right? And so start by walking us through why you think there is a particularly elevated risk of election-related violence in this cycle.
I'm going to recast this slightly, and I want to focus on your last words, which is elevated risk. My hope, which is a real possibility, is that Election Day will pass with no significant incidents of violence. And that could very well happen. But I would stress that there's a higher risk this year than in any time in recent history. And let me give a couple reasons and then ask Colin to chime in. So one, as you mentioned, is the intense degree of polarization, that you have a good chunk of the electorate that sees the people voting for the other side not only as mistaken, but as somehow deeply flawed and at times even evil, that they believe in a vision of America that is wrong and is not simply a matter of disagreement, but is a matter of morals. Also, we've seen over the last summer, and then even before that, we've seen quite a bit of social tension with regard to protests over police violence, and then the range of violent right-wing organizations reacting to it. And so we've had demonstrations, some violent, and we've had shootings and killings. And for many people, this is woven up in our broader politics. So we have this violence that flares up from time to time and is quite strong in people's minds as we go into the election. And then, very importantly, we have the president of the United States, who at times seems to egg on some of the people on the crazy extreme, whether it's the QAnon types or right-wing militias, but has also tried to delegitimize the American electoral process, talking about fraud constantly, calling for people to ensure that the vote is secure, a lot of things that aren't even dog whistles, are really just whistles for violence. So you have a series of factors that are quite strong. Not that they were completely absent in the past, but they were much less present. And all these have me concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I'll largely echo what Dan said. I think clearly polarization has reached levels that I've never experienced in my lifetime. I think COVID introduces an entirely new dynamic to this. People have been cooped up for months. If you look at gun sales and ammunition sales, every month sets a new record. And then, you know, the president's rhetoric, which is pouring accelerant on top of all this, agree with Dan. It's not just a dog whistle. I'd say it's even beyond a whistle. It's a bullhorn. He's calling for people to show up to the polls, to become poll watchers. Why is he doing that? He's saying to watch the other side cheat. So if you're showing up with arms to an election that you believe is existential, and you also believe that the other side is cheating, and that's happening in 50 states across the country, I think the potential for even sheer miscommunication, right, or an argument that escalates is high. It's higher than it's been to me in the past. Then you have kind of more sinister elements at play where you have actual violent extremists. And there's a number of terms that we can use to describe them. And different agencies in the government use different terms, but if you look at the great report that the Center for Strategic and International Studies released just last week, Seth Jones was the lead author. It showed that violence in this country, at least in 2020, from January 1st to the end of August, is driven by the far right. I think we all recognize that. Beyond just the kind of militias, you actually have accelerationists, people that want civil war. They want to tear down the system. And I look at the polling stations and election day is very symbolic of, you know, institutions in this country. And so they, to me, present pretty attractive targets for those that say, this is their words, we want to destroy the system. We want to burn it to the ground.
So we talk about political violence in the context of elections as though it is sort of a foreign thing to the United States a lot of the time. But the truth of the matter is that this country has quite a history of election-related violence. Even if you exclude from that the molten core of election-related violence, which is violent efforts to prevent Black people from voting in the civil rights and pre-civil rights eras. You know, 1968 is a violent period, and our kind of modern conception of American elections, that they are peaceful affairs, is a bit of a modern conceit. So give us a sense of when the last time there was significant violence in the context of a U.S. election was. You know, maybe one way to see your anxieties about this is that you're describing a elevated risk of the United States returning to something like a norm.
I certainly hope that's not true, although it very well may be. What I would stress is that if we go back to the 1960s, to me, we saw two forms of violence that were very strong. So one, as you mentioned, was, you know, blatant systematic attempts to use violence against Black people who tried to vote. And in a way, that happened less in the decades before that simply because the system was so strong and oppressive that fewer Black people dared. And so the system was in flux and the violence increased as a result of that challenge. But also, as you say, we had political assassinations. And we can kind of go figure by figure and talk about whether the assassin was kind of crazy or what the motivation was. But these had a profound impact. The assassination of Robert Kennedy, you know, may have changed who ended up being the Democratic nominee and who ended up being the president of the United States as a result.
And people forget this, but that was specifically election violence. It was in the context of a political campaign.
It was right after the California primary and his victory there, right? I mean, it was very much in this context. So certainly violence is a thing of the past, but that was terrible. And as you said, you know, we have moved past this or seem to for the last almost 50 years. And that's been a tremendous success in American history. But also, this is a little different in that right now we're also talking violence at the polls. And obviously, this happened in the civil rights era against Black Americans, but this could be a nationwide thing that we're seeing individuals who are threatening the polls. And again, this may just be big talk. We may look back and say there was a lot of hot air, but it's enough hot air where I'm quite concerned.
Yeah, I would say I also hope that we're wrong, frankly. And there's a number of different scenarios where I think the levels of violence could be greater or lesser, depending on what actually happens. And depending on how long it takes until we have a firm answer and result. If the election results drag on for days or weeks, I think that is the most vulnerable period. But I do think the comparison to the late 60s, and I would even argue maybe the early 70s, is apt if we want to take a step back and look at the broader political context, at least from domestic terrorism, because you had such a range of groups operating back then. You had anti-Vietnam War protests, you had Black Panthers. Certainly the left was more energized. And I think we're seeing some of that today. You know, the president has gone on record saying he wants to designate Antifa as a terrorist group. That's become a cudgel for many on the right. I mean, even in regular conversations I have when I talk about the threat of neo-Nazis, the immediate knee-jerk response is, what about Antifa? And, you know, the fact of the matter is they're not comparable. We're talking about people that are largely breaking windows and using spray paint with people that are using guns and bombs. So, however, that's not to suggest that we couldn't see more violence from the left. And I am a big believer in this concept of reciprocal radicalization, right? Antifa is an anti-fascist group. As there are more fascists, there will be more anti-fascists. And so this kind of yin and yang, as one side grows stronger, the other does as well. I think, you know, it just feels like we're headed toward some kind of almost cataclysmic event. And that, to me, is the election and what ultimately happens. So it's very kind of unnerving times. I talk to a lot of colleagues in federal law enforcement and they say the same things. This really feels different. You know, when we're talking about kind of foreign meddling or Russian interference, that's one thing. But here, this just seems far more unpredictable in terms of what could actually happen. And I think disinformation plays a role too. I mean, you know, we've already seen all of these kind of hoaxes of Antifa buses and planes showing up places, but, you know, far-right extremists that are heavily armed react to that and they actually show up. So if we see some of that on election day, I think that could be really a recipe for disaster.
So I'm not sure throwing cold water is the right metaphor, since I think you both would be thrilled if your thesis were incorrect. But I want to think about some reasons to be a little bit more sanguine than you guys are on this question. And one of them is the percentage of people who have already voted. You know, we are something like 60% as we are recording on Friday, something like 60% of the 2016 electorate has already voted this year, either early or by mail. That number will go up substantially between now and Election Day as more mail-in votes come in and as people do early voting over the course of the weekend. And in some states, like Texas, this number is astronomically high, 95% 8% as we're recording of the 2016 electorate. Now, of course, it will not be capped at 100% because, you know, the total electorate this year probably will exceed the total electorate in 2016. But with so many people already having voted, I wonder if that actually makes Election Day violence a little bit less interesting from the point of view of the would-be perpetrators. That is, fewer people there. There are many fewer people to intimidate. The people who are most likely to be intimidatable may well have voted early precisely to avoid this kind of intimidation. And so I guess hopeful scenario number one is we've let some of the air out of the balloon by having the degree of early voting, particularly in certain states, that we have had. Your thoughts?
So I think you're overstating the kind of strategic nature of a number of the people who might do this sort of thing, that they're kind of, you know, carefully reading 538 and saying, yeah, you know, this particular district or this state isn't worth it because it's probably reached a tipping point already. I think there'll be enough people at the polls and enough attention to those people at the polls where I don't think that calculation will have a big impact. My hope is, though, that should there be violence, that it will have less impact, as you say, because more people have voted in advance and thus there are simply fewer votes to sway. And that's, I would say, one concern is that an incident in one county that normally would not get much attention will get far more attention due to the, you know, that we're all waiting for this news and the rapidity of social media. So that kind of echo effect is very strong, but hopefully would be diminished. Let me put a different piece of good news on the table, though, because I think this is very important. The fact that we're talking about violence is not something, as Colin said, that's a surprise in the least to law enforcement officials. And if you look at the plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, for example, you know, one way to look at this is, oh my God, this is horrible. Can you believe these people were doing it? Another way is, good job, FBI. Good job, law enforcement. They were really on it. And they seem to really be paying a lot of attention and really focused on this threat. So I think that some of the more likely suspects are also more likely to be monitored for violence. That doesn't mean that individuals who are off the radar screen won't do things. But I think that at least is one silver lining that I'm hopeful about.
Yeah, I think that's a story that doesn't get enough attention, unfortunately. And it's because it is a good news story, right? That the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Forces are highly competent and good at their jobs, and frankly, are much better positioned to infiltrate far-right extremist groups than they were Al-Qaeda. You know, I mean, getting into these groups, there's no cultural or language barrier. They were good at this in the 90s, and they continue to be good at it. I think one of the things that concerns me the most, as Dan mentioned, were the folks that are off the radar, either because they are, you know, planning something surreptitiously and being a bit more careful about whom they talk to and on what platforms because of the plots that have already been disrupted, but more so the people that have no record because they're new to this. And I think, again, I'll go back to COVID. It's brought so many more people in front of their laptops, on their phones for just such a longer period of time. The QAnon phenomenon, if you want to label it a phenomenon, is just so strange to me. And I think, again, is probably the hardest to predict what will happen. I mean, if you actually look at Pizzagate and then some of the other incidents where QAnon has spilled over into real world violence, it's just so bizarre that people believe these things, right? That there's a sex trafficking ring being run out of a DC pizzeria. I mean, it's crazy, right? But if you look at the numbers now of kind of Telegram groups and others, this has proliferated across this country, across the world. If you talk to folks like Christian Piccolini, that worked to help bring people away from violence and out of these violent movements, he says the majority of his time now is consumed by QAnon, you know, not white supremacy. So I think we might underestimate how many people are really kind of enamored with this. And if things don't go their way on Election Day, may, you know, bring that from behind the computer to real life.
Is your primary concern terrorism, that is an attack on a polling place, or is it that, you know, people will sort of show up in, you know, armed kind of shows of force, and there will be confrontations between different groups of people who, for different reasons, see themselves as protecting the integrity of the election? One group because they're there to prevent voter fraud, right, and watch the polls a la Donald Trump's instructions during the debate, and one group because they're there to protect the right of people to vote, or even because they're there to vote themselves.
I would say my biggest concern is that mix of people who think they're protecting their own right combined with voter intimidation. That people who have a genuine belief that, you know, as Colin said, a kind of a QAnon crazy belief, but nevertheless a genuinely held one, that their right to vote is being taken away. And they're going to show up at the polls and exercise that right. But that might mean coming armed. It also might mean trying to intimidate the people they believe are fake voters who are voting in the millions, even though that statistic is complete fraud and this is really not a significant problem, people believe it is. And so to me, the bigger problem is armed voter intimidation rather than terrorism thought of in kind of traditional terms of a polling place being blown up. But I could imagine that line becoming very muddy where an individual going to part of town that has a large Mexican-American population, for example, and seeing people vote and believing that they're all illegal immigrants who are voting and opening fire because they're destroying democracy. And so I worry about these intersections of crazy conspiracies with the kind of broader critique that more legitimate conservatives are making that is false, but overlaps with the dangerous violent types.
What's different now is that there's so many different possibilities. So I don't, of course, terrorism's on the table, right? And we need to look out for bots like we saw with the governor of Michigan. That's your kind of higher echelon, something that's planned, that's specific, that's symbolic, right? That's meant to terrorize. And then I think, you know, you have variations of that. I think you have what we kind of jokingly refer to as LARPers sometimes, right? These live action role players, people that get dressed up in all their kit and their guns, and, you know, they head out for the day. You look at someone like Kyle Rittenhouse, right? And I don't think he went there that day looking to kill someone, but he did. You know, he killed two people. So I think confusion is something that we also is going to play a huge role. And knowing who's actually law enforcement, who's not. So you could see escalation there and just miscommunication. And, you know, and then I think your garden variety hotheads, people that are very excited about their candidate. They want to shove that in your face. And the fact that we live in a country where so many people are armed, that just increases the chances that things are going to, you know, cascade. This is a story that really hasn't gotten as much coverage, or maybe it has, but the vehicle attacks. I mean, at all these demonstrations and protests, I mean, we've seen a number of vehicle attacks, and that's something that is obviously concerning too. So I think a lot about the different tactics that we could see on Election Day, and that's certainly one of them.
So what is not being done that should be being done? Part of what you're describing, you both said earlier that the FBI has been extremely competent in addressing the higher echelon type of violence, the most dramatic example of that being the disruption of the Whitmer plot. But we can assume, I think, that the same visibility that the Bureau had into that group of people is probably in real time being replicated across a number of other threat vectors across the country. So I'm not sure I see at the higher levels what should be being done that isn't. But I do wonder about the lower levels, which is largely a state and local set of issues. Is there stuff that should be happening at polling places to protect them that is not happening? Are there known kind of standards of law enforcement behavior or polling place behavior to maximize safety? Like, if you guys were the gurus, if a polling place called you up or a county called you up and said, hey, we read your piece and we really want to make sure that this stuff doesn't happen here, how should we be thinking about polling place security to protect us from the people who show up claiming to be guaranteeing polling place security?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on polling places specifically. And here, it cuts both ways, because I think you would want some kind of official visible presence to let people know that who is actually law enforcement and who's not. But even there, a lot of these accelerationist groups, I mean, if you look at the Boogaloo Boys, that's who they want to target, is law enforcement. They see them as the actual enemy. You know, your question of what's not being done, I'll let Dan talk to the specifics of maybe what's not being done at polling stations. And I know this kind of sounds ridiculous because we know that this will never happen, but it seems like such common sense. And it also seems strange to how we got to this place. What's not being done is the president of the United States isn't urging people to be calm, to go and to vote and to respect the other side. He's actually doing the opposite. If you were to make a movie about this and you were to cast him in this role, I would say it seems really far-fetched. No president of the United States is ever going to sink to that level. It doesn't make any sense. But here we are. I mean, he is literally agitating his followers he's walking right up to the line, go to the polling stations, watch the cheating that's happening, knowing full well that many of them will be armed. You know, you opened the podcast by saying this is stuff that we expect in other countries. And unfortunately, this does happen in other countries, but now it's happening here. And I think we've all got outrage fatigue at a lot of the things that happen, but we shouldn't let this pass as normal. And I certainly, you know, don't think it's normal. And I don't think many people find this to be normal behavior. So, you know, the president needs to be called out for sowing the seeds, both on social media and, you know, at his rallies.
In addition to the president, I would also say, you know, political leaders of all stripes, right? And this has unfortunately been a much bigger problem with many Republican political leaders, where they need to show their independence from the president and say that we're going to have free and fair elections and that voter fraud is not a massive problem. And, you know, stress the need for peace, and that, you know, if, as is likely, we do not know the results of a state like Pennsylvania for several days because of early voting, that's called democracy. And it's great that lots of people voted. It's not this massive fraud that's going on while they're counting the votes. And so I think one individual, the president, bears particular responsibility because he's the president. But there's a large number of people who also have responsibility here. To talk a bit more at the state and local level, they are, of course, you know, I'll say in a position where there are going to be different local laws about open carry and firearms in general. They're vulnerable to outside actors outside their jurisdiction. But all of them should be prepared in a rapid response sort of way to be able to contain violence. And what you don't want is, you know, significant shows of force at polling places. For many communities, that's intimidation. Right, the idea that, you know, in the past, the United States, we've seen police and National Guard used to prevent voting. And so we very much want to ensure that all people are eager to go to the polls. But at the same time, if trouble breaks out, you want a very rapid response. And to go back to Cowan's point about this reciprocal radicalization, that you could imagine one incident isolated, a couple hotheads on both sides, shouldn't be a big deal, but it goes viral very quickly and inspires others to go out. So speed really matters. And this is going to require state and local officials to be on alert. It also requires a lot of coordination. And this is something that I don't know how much it's being done at the federal level, because in a way it goes against what the president himself is urging. The federal government can be very good at this coordination function, can be very good at providing resources, at surging capacity, at providing information. And this is a really important role. So I hope it's being done, but I'm nervous it's not, even though to me the necessity is quite clear.
So one actor that we have not talked about that plays an enormous role in this is the social media platforms. And if there is, you know, contagion in the violence, it will almost certainly be because people tweet about it, people share stuff on Facebook, people call out their communities through a variety of social media channels. We know that the social media platforms have, you know, created a bunch of special rules for the election period, you know, forbidding, in Facebook's cases, you know, new political ads during this period, being quite careful with premature claims of victory. How does the social media company's policies play into the violence concerns that you guys raise?
I think, you know, this is one of the areas where I do see overlap between two distinct threats to the election, the one being domestic political violence, the other being foreign influence meddling. And I think, you know, if we do see some early examples of violence at the polls, you know, that's blood in the water for external actors like the Russians to begin amplifying that, to begin flooding these channels with this information. So the more groundwork is done, you know, and I know that things are being done now to identify and remove inauthentic actors and others, the better. But I guess I'm somewhat skeptical that the companies are doing a comprehensive job, just because, you know, this always becomes an issue, right, around any big event. And I think, I don't know, there's just so much at stake in this election that for the Russians, you know, we've even seen the Iranians and the Chinese get involved, although they're not as sophisticated as what the Russians are doing. This is the World Series for them. I mean, they're you know, waiting to cause chaos and really, you know, I think wreak havoc. And so to me, it's kind of the perfect storm.
I'll add that. So the good news is, you know, Facebook, other social media companies, they recognize this is the World Series too. And they've been focused on this issue for over a year, right? They've been gearing up for this moment. So the hope is that, you know, they're reasonably prepared. There are a couple issues I would stress. One is they really need to coordinate with each other. If there is a bad actor that Facebook discovers and they deplatform him, it doesn't do much good if that bad actor shows up on YouTube, right? That you really want a lot of coordination. And the second thing you want is very, very aggressive interpretations of terms of service, right? So at this particular time, I'm actually quite fine with false positives, right? That I'd much rather they err on the side of stopping any talk of violence, stopping any sport of violence, when having a more nuanced policy may make more sense if the risk is more abstract, if there's no precipitating event. We have a potential precipitating event with the elections. We have reason to think the risk is high, and they bear a lot of responsibility. And also, many of them need to make sure that there's capacity for smaller platforms. The smaller platforms don't have the danger of mass incitement, right? There are many people on some of these very obscure platforms, but there are at times collections of very bad actors on relatively obscure platforms. And sometimes it's a case where the platform simply doesn't care, but sometimes the platform itself needs assistance. And that's something that the bigger companies, the Facebooks, the Googles, can really assist with.
One of the factors that you mention in the piece, which you also mentioned very briefly in passing in this conversation, was the elevated sales of guns and ammunition and background checks that the FBI is experiencing right now. A lot of people are going to listen to this and say, you guys are really alarmists, and maybe Wittes shouldn't be giving you a platform to scare everybody about the election. And the high likelihood is that this election is going to come and go. We're going to count a lot of votes. We're going to have loud arguments about it. One side or the other is going to win. And one thing that isn't going to happen is a whole lot of violence. And you all are going to look pretty silly, as is Wittes for hosting you for this conversation, warning of systemic violence. So first of all, I want you to talk about the specific indicia of people preparing for violence, including but not limited to gun sales and ammunition sales. But secondly, I want you to address the what if you're wrong question. Obviously, you'd be happy to be wrong, but you know, people warn of all kinds of things that don't happen. And are there negative consequences of sort of being over-concerned about violence that then does not materialize?
Yeah, I think that's something that I was certainly concerned about when we first started writing this piece. And I don't consider myself a threat inflator. You know, and we've seen this movie before with, you know, jihadi terrorism. You know, and Dan's, you know, book, Road Warriors, amazing book on foreign fighters. I think, you know, there was a lot of alarm around what happens when the caliphate is crushed and all of these foreign fighters flood back to their countries. You know, we're going to be seeing terrorist attacks on a weekly basis. And that didn't happen. And one of the factors is that a lot of these foreign fighters died and were killed in combat. This is a little bit different because let's just say that we weren't having the election. Let's put the election on the side. Would we expect to see just kind of violence on par with what we've seen so far this year? And we've had a violent year. I mean, we've seen, you know, various plots disrupted. And I think that's another thing is we often only focus on the successful attacks. We don't focus enough on the plots. But looking at the plots gives you a sense of, you know, op tempo, operational tempo, with the frequency with which things are happening. And there were some pretty significant plots that were disrupted earlier this year, including, you know, someone that wanted to target a Jewish nursing home and blow it up. So I'm a big believer in, and this is the same thing with jihadis that I look for with domestic terrorists, believe what people say. When they tell you they're going to do something, believe them. Now, some of it is bluster, of course, but when you look at a group like the Oath Keepers, you know, who are comprised primarily of former military and law enforcement, Stuart Rose, their leader, just the other day said, we are prepared to go to the polls and if need be, kill Democrats. So I think it's actually more irresponsible to downplay that and say, nah, you know, he's full of it. We don't believe him because these people are armed and they've told you their intent. So if there is no violence, that would be the question I'm asking. Why wasn't there violence? Why didn't these people follow through on what they said they were going to do? And I don't think you can ever be prepared enough. So if we err on the side of caution and preparing for violence that doesn't happen, great. I'm glad it didn't happen. But I'll be then doing the kind of forensics to figure out why. Why have all these political scientists and policy analysts and law enforcement officials themselves who have seen this kind of factors coming together to make people on edge, to cause this tinderbox? What caused it not to happen? And I'll gladly eat crow if it doesn't. I mean, I hope it doesn't happen.
Let me add briefly that there's a good chance violence won't happen. Right, we are talking about elevated risk, right? So if you are, you know, listening to the weather report and they say there's a risk of flooding, right? There are certain behaviors you avoid. You know, don't go canoeing that day. You might want to check on your basement a bit more. That we, no one thinks, oh, a flood is definitely going to happen. People are aware that they're saying the chances increase significantly, right? And that applies to a whole range of phenomena. And at times, you know, the risk is high enough where you simply don't do something, right? So, you know, you can fly an airplane through a thunderstorm, but it's higher risk and a stupid idea. So we generally don't do it. So we are saying the risk is higher. And if we're wrong, right, there was a waste of resources, right? You had presumably some of the state, local, and federal effort that we've talked about a bit was not necessary. A bigger risk is that some people don't show up because they're afraid of violence. The great news so far is that people are highly energized, right? That fear factor doesn't seem to be playing in, but that is a real legitimate concern. But I would stress that when we think about risk, we have to think about this in two ways. One is, of course, the destruction of property, people being injured, and God forbid, people being killed, right? That's a real risk. What makes this even more troubling than that horrible possibility is that this is really the core of American democracy that we're discussing, that so much of what our country stands for, what people have died for, what people have struggled for, is the right to vote freely. And if the risk of that being jeopardized is higher, that's a tremendous concern, even if the risk goes from 1% to 5%, right? So that possibility to me is incredibly scary and deserves to be guarded against. And I'll be delighted if it doesn't happen. But the fact that we're talking about it and that so many people are concerned about it, to me, suggests we need to guard against this because the threat itself is so serious as it strikes at the heart of our institutions.
We're going to leave it there. Dan Byman, Colin Clark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our public relations firm is You Guys, which is to say, you need to do your part to make sure other people know about the Lawfare Podcast. So tweet us, share us on Facebook, upvote us on Reddit, pin us on Pinterest, and of course, leave a rating or review wherever you found us. You should buy Lawfare merch at the Lawfare store. And you should thank Sophia Yan, who performs our music as ever. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.